as we all know, we are on the cusp, we're on the verge of celebrating, of commemorating the holiday of Purim. And what is extremely unusual, what is unique about the great celebration of Purim is that Purim was really a diaspora holiday. It was a holiday that took place, all the miracles happened in Galus, nothing happened in Eretz Yisrael, everything was in Persia, everything was Iran, after they were kicked out of Eretz Yisrael. It's a story about a Persian king, as we know, Ahasuerus, who even after the great miracle and the great salvation and everything that happened with the Jewish people, he still remains the king. You contrast that with the story of Hanukkah and you find that there was an uprising and the Jews decided to fight for themselves, they decided to defend themselves, and after that whole story was over, we reverted back to being under our own sovereignty once again. The story of Purim was not that way. The story of Purim, we remained in Galus after the story was over, and Ahasuerus remained the one in control, and we were not the ones who were running the show. If it is the story as well of Mordechai and Esther, who were two Jews living in Shushan HaBira, the way we are introduced to Mordechai is, Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan HaBira, Rabbi Yonasan Eibishitz writes, there were two different places. One was Shushan, and one was Shushan HaBira. Shushan HaBira was like New York City, and Shushan was just New York in general. So he was in the thick of everything. He was in New York City, not just he was living in the country, in the community. He was in the thick of the politics. He was in the middle of everything. And he was a Jew who rose to the top in a very non-Jewish environment. That was what was extremely unique about the story of Purim. However, when you look through the Megillah and you ask yourself, who exactly is considered to be the main hero, the main protagonist of the Purim story? So if you ask any Jew, they'll say it was probably Mordechai, it was Esther. You can argue, you can debate which one was more worthy. But in the end of the day, if you look through the Megillah itself, that does not seem to be so clear. That does not seem to be so obvious at all. And what I mean by that is the following. If you look through the Megillah, the name, the personality that is mentioned more than anyone else is not Mordechai, it is not Esther, but it is rather HaMelech Ahasuerus. We are incessantly talking about Ahasuerus over and over again. And you look through and you find that hundreds of times it would seem that throughout the whole story and the whole scheme that took place, it would seem that he is the central figure, that he is the axis to all that went on, and that all of the story seems to revolve around him. Nowhere in the Megillah do we find that all of the emotions are described about any of the other characters. It doesn't say Mordechai was angry, it doesn't say Mordechai was happy, it doesn't say any of that. But by Ahasuerus, every step of the way we're told, Ahasuerus is mad, and Ahasuerus is happy, and now he can't sleep, and now he's going to a party, and he's going here, and he's telling Haman to do that. Everything about Ahasuerus' personality is described, everything about his emotions and his frustrations, everything is laid out for us in the Megillah. Now, even when we are told about the great Mordechai in the end, when the great miracle took place, and he was the one who was very highly responsible for that, what are we told? The description that the Megillah gives is, Ki Mordechai HaYehudi, how do you want to talk about Mordechai? Mishnah LaMelech Ahasuerus. Even when we're talking about our own hero, we still say the fact that he has some connection to Ahasuerus. Everything in the Megillah seems to be about Ahasuerus. And yet, despite the fact that Ahasuerus seems to be the one who is this highly celebrated, very effective, very powerful king, you look at the story and it seems that it's not so simple. And it seems that he is in some way incapable of making his own decisions. And he is really an ineffective leader, although there is a great significance given to him throughout the story of the Megillah. What I mean by that is as follows. There's almost no portion of the Megillah. There's almost no portion of the story in which we find that Ahasuerus on his own is able to make a decision. Almost everything that happened is because someone else told him to do it. So he gets angry at his wife Vashti, and he didn't have the idea to kill her. It was Haman stands up with the idea to kill her. And we're told later on that he decides to get a new queen. That wasn't his idea. He didn't suggest that he should have a new queen and we should have all the women coming in to try out to figure out who's worthy of being the queen to Ahasuerus. It was somebody else, an advisor, gives him this idea. And then, once the decision is made that he wants to go and annihilate and destroy the Jewish people, once again, that was not an idea, it was a very critical decision in his life, but it was not made by him himself. That was something that was suggested by one of his advisors once again. Finally, when he gets angry at Haman, so we're told he wants to take revenge and he wants to hang him, that was not the idea of Ahasuerus either. We're told that one of the ministers, one of the advisors of Ahasuerus, gives over the idea, oh, you know, by the way, there's this big eitz, there's this big gallows that Haman has made, why don't we use that to hang Haman himself? It's such an oddity, it's so strange that if you have this unbelievably essential figure that is spoken about hundreds of times throughout the Megillah, that seems to be so effective and so powerful, yet at the same time he's an individual who seems not to be able to do anything. He's just a follower, he's just a participant, he's just going along with what other people tell him, and he himself cannot be the one who is responsible for any activities in his life. And that is why Chazal tell us he was referred to as the Melech Tipish. He was a fool. He was a man who was so ineffective. He was a person who could not be a powerful monarch at all because everything in his life was being run by other people. And if that is really the case, that is the personality of Ahasuerus, we go back to the question, why is he mentioned so many times? Why is there such a significance that is handed over to Ahasuerus and about everything that he's thinking and every juncture of the way, what does he say and what does he feel? He's not even the one who's leading the charge. Why do we speak so much at length about Ahasuerus in the Megillah? And the answer to that, I believe, is something that I once heard when I was learning in yeshiva, and that is a beautiful idea that although Mordechai and Esther were the ones who were responsible for writing the Megillah and for this document being given over to the Jews, they always had to keep in mind a very delicate balance, and that was the fact that they were still living in Galus. So you want to make a Megillah and you want to celebrate, you want to highlight the incredible miracle that happened to the Jewish people, you cannot forget that you're still living under the monarch. You're still living under an authority that is not your own. You're still living under a government that you have to abide by their laws and you have to have their sensitivities in mind as well. And therefore, Mordechai and Esther, when they write this Megillah, they make sure to obviously highlight the incredible miracle that happened to the Jewish people. But while doing that, they always have to be sensitive to the fact that we need to tone it down. There have to be two versions of the Megillah. And as we know, the Megillah is written behester. There is always the meaning, there is the pshat, when you read the story itself, when you read the words. But behind every word in the Megillah, there is so much meaning, there is so much understanding that was not there. Why was the Megillah written in such a way? Because Mordechai always had to make sure that it was, in his own words, it was divrei shalom ve'emes. Why does Mordechai say he's writing a Megillah that is divrei shalom ve'emes? The answer is because he had this dual role in writing the Megillah. On the one hand, he wrote divrei emes. He had to write the truth. And the Jews needed to know the true story so that zichram layasav mizaram, future generations would always be reminded of the incredible story, the great miracle, the triumph of the Jews in the times of Mordechai and Esther. That's the divrei emes. But at the same time, Mordechai had to make sure while writing it that it was written in a fashion that was also divrei shalom. He had to do it in a way where he wasn't going to upset the monarch that was still ruling over the Jewish people. As we said, the story of Purim was unique because even after the great Yeshua, even after the great salvation, they still remained in Galus. They did not have their own government. They did not have their own sovereignty. It was all under the guise of a foreign country, of a foreign nation. It's interesting that you'll notice throughout the Megillah, almost never is there a mention of any religious, any Jewish practices. You ever notice that? So we're told, Mordechai lo yichra ve lo yishtachave. Mordechai will not bow down. Why not? The Megillah doesn't say why. What, he didn't like him? It doesn't identify the main reason, the critical focus of why it is that he wouldn't bow down. So the Gemara expands on it. The Gemara says, because Haman had this idol around him, and therefore Mordechai was afraid to bow down. But nowhere do we see in the Megillah, in the text itself, that it was because of a concern for Avodah Zarah. That is not mentioned. And it was deliberately left out. You look a little bit further in the Megillah, and we're told that Esther tells all the Jews to get together and make a 3-day fast. And when she wants all of them to get together and do what? By Yizak, everyone's crying. Nowhere does it say that they're engaged in tefillah. Nowhere does it say who they're addressing in their prayers, who they're crying to. All of that is left out. Why is the Ribono Shel Olam not part of that discussion? The answer is because when Mordechai has to write this Megillah down for all future generations, he has to be sensitive to the fact that it has to be done in a very particular way. We don't want to upset Ahasuerus in the way we recount the story. So yes, it's true. Ahasuerus was a person who really did not have any power. And everything in his life that was done was only because someone else suggested that it be done for him. And nothing was able to be effectuated by his own decisions. But yet, Mordechai goes out of his way to give all the credit to Ahasuerus, to tell the world that this is the person who was the monarch, this is the person who was powerful, he was the one who was effectuating change. He was the reason why everything happened, because Mordechai always had to make sure to strike that balance between the Divrei Shalom and the Divrei Emes. In the very end of the Megillah, we find that Mordechai and Esther institute this incredible holiday of Purim. And what do they say? They tell us that we should make sure Mishte v'Simcha, Matanos le'Avyonim, Mishloach Manos, it's all wonderful, a big party, great celebration. Nowhere does it say that we should make time for Halal v'Hodah. Isn't that strange? Wouldn't it make sense that at some point over the holiday of Purim we should go out of our way to thank the Ribono Shel Olam for the great salvation? Nowhere in the Megillah is that mentioned. How can it be? How did Mordechai leave out the most critical component of what a Yom Tov is supposed to be? Chatzil Hashem. You have to give some of your celebration over to God. The answer is he deliberately left it out. because this Megillah always had to strike that balance between, on the one hand, the Divrei Shalom, and on the other hand, the Divrei Emes. And this is the truth. This is the story of the Jew in Galus throughout all the millennia. This is the difficult balance that we always have to figure out how to make, and it's a very delicate one, to figure out how, on the one hand, to stick to our principles, to defend the truth, and to stick up for what it is that we believe in, the Divrei Emes, but at the same time, always to live a life under the authority that we live under in Galus, that we do not have our own sovereignty, we do not have our own right to govern over ourselves. We always have to be sure that it's done in a way which is also in the Divrei Shalom, the same way that Mordechai HaTzadik did it. We always have to strike that very complex and that very difficult balance that Jews in Galus always have to make sure to make. The Vilna Gaon writes in his commentary on Megillas Esther, he has a comment based on a halacha that the Gemara gives. The Gemara tells us, HaKorei Megillah lemafreya lo yatsa. The Gemara tells us, if you read the Megillah out of order, you have not fulfilled your obligation. Simply translated, it means if you read Perek Gimel before Perek Aleph, you're not going to understand the sequence of the story. So it's important that you read everything in order. This way you'll have the complete context of everything that happened and you'll fully appreciate the miracle. Writes the Vilna Gaon, and how do I know that it's MS? Because obviously everything the Vilna Gaon says is probably true, but the Vilna Gaon said it and the Baal Shem Tov said it, and you have on both sides of the aisle, everyone agreed that this is the Vart. What is the Vart? HaKorei LeMafreya doesn't only mean if you read the story out of order, but the Vilna Gaon suggested it means also HaKorei LeMafreya, someone who reads the story of the Megillah, someone who recounts the great miracle of Mordechai and Esther, Achashverosh, Haman, and thinks that it's all in Mafreya, and thinks this is all just a piece of previous history, and doesn't understand that this is what we are currently living through in our generation in Galus as well. Lo Yatza, you've missed the boat. You have not fully internalized what Purim is meant to teach all of us. Purim is the guide for the Galus Jew, because this is really the life that we've been living, the experience that we've had since the times of Mordechai and Esther, and this is why we are told, HaKorei LeMafreya, Lo Yatza Yedecha Vaza. The Kedushas Levi, the Bardichiva, writes in one of his Svarim, isn't it strange? We had incredible miracles not only on Purim, not only on Hanukkah, but certainly we had great miracles on Pesach. Well, if that's the case, ask the Kedushas Levi, why do we not make a bracha Sha'asam Nisim Lavosenu by Yamim Ahem Bazman Azeh? Why don't we make such a bracha on Pesach the same way we make it on Purim and on Hanukkah? If, after all, the miracles on Pesach were so much more astounding, but so much more alarming than those on Hanukkah and Purim, why do we not make the bracha Sha'asa Nisim? Suggest the Kedushas Levi, because those miracles that took place on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim were one-time miracles. They'll never happen again. Nisim, Gluyim, unbelievable things. The world came to a halt. Everybody was watching. Hayam Rav, Hayanos, the world was upside down. Everybody knew what was happening. Those kinds of miracles are not ones that are by Yamim Mahem Bazman Hazeh. That is not the life that the Jews have been living ever since that experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and therefore it would be inappropriate to say, Sha'asa Nisim Lavosena, we ask the same miracles that you did for them on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim, you should do for us today as well. That is not appropriate. However, writes the Kedushas Levi, when we talk about our experience in the story of Purim, or Hanukkah, where it was pretty hidden, and after all you had, in the story of Hanukkah, you had Yael goes ahead and does whatever she does very privately, and because of that, they win the war. And you have the Jews in the story of Purim. Mordechai makes his way into the cabinet. Mordechai makes his way in, and Haman somehow gets taken down, and Esther is rising to power, and everything seems to be happening in a very natural and subtle way. That, writes the Kedushas Levi, would be appropriate for your Jew to ask, the same way we had miracles then, which were so subtle, which were so unique, which were so quiet. That is what we pray for, that is what we ask for in our generation as well. And this is really the story, the unique story of the survival of the Jewish people. The Yavetz famously writes in his Siddur that if he had to imagine what is the greatest miracle since the world has been created, he says the story of the Jewish survival has been a greater miracle than the Bria Shamayim Va'aretz. It's a greater and more astounding miracle than the creation of the world itself. Just think about the trajectory of our history and how unusual it is, how improbable it is that we would still be here. Se'achas ben shivim ze'evim. We are a small nation that is inundated with haters, that is surrounded with people who all they want is to destroy us. And this has been omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu. In every generation, there is nothing unique, there is nothing unusual about it. Let us just close with an insight about the laning that we're about to do now, that we do every year, every time we have an opportunity to lane from Parshas Kisisa on a Tainus Tzibur. Very quick thought. We're told, Vayomer, Hine Anochi Kareis Bris Neged Kalamcha Esenif Loz. God promises us that He's going to do the most unbelievable miracles. Asher lo nivru v'chal ha'aretz v'chal ha'gayim, that nobody has ever experienced, that nobody has ever seen. Ask the Ramban on Chumash, what is God referring to? Where did that promise ever come to fruition? Where did we see that God ever repeated a miracle that was as great as the miracle of Yetzias Mitzrayim? Where have we ever seen that, asked the Ramban? Isn't this an empty promise? And we say it every time we lane from Parshas Kisisa on a Tainus Tzibur, and we never think about the words. We have never seen a miracle as great as the experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim. What is God assuring Moshe Rabbeinu of? What does he mean? That I'm going to show you the greatest miracles that you've never seen. Lo nivru'u b'chal ha'aretz v'chal ha'gayim. Asked the Ramban the question, and he gets into a complicated answer, but Rav Shach suggested maybe the understanding is, if you go back one pasuk before that, Moshe Rabbeinu requests the following. He says, V'salachta la'avoneinu l'chatoseinu unechaltanu. Rashi on Chumash writes, what does he mean, unechaltanu? What does that word connote? What is it supposed to mean to all of us? Rashi suggests it means, unechaltanu, it means, v'titnenu l'cha l'nachala. We ask the Ribbono Shel Olam, you should put us as part of your eternal heritage. We should be as part of an inseparable bond. The Jewish people should be the most everlasting force in the world. And that, writes Rav Shach, is the greatest miracle, and that's more profound than Bria Shamayim Va'aretz, that's more profound than Yetzias Mitzrayim, that's greater than anything else. And that is the answer to the Ramban's question. What does it mean when we say in our laning that the Ribbono Shel Olam, God, is going to show his people miracles, asher lo nivru'u b'chal ha'aretz v'chal ha'gayim, that no one has ever experienced? The answer is, the survival of the Jewish people is the greatest miracle we will ever see and we will ever experience. And when you think about that critically, you understand that it is so much more profound and it is so much more highlighted than any other miracle that our people has ever experienced, because this is one that has gone on for thousands and thousands of years. And this is what we ask for. Tonight, when we say the bracha she'asan nisim l'avoseinu, we ask that the Ribbono Shel Olam give us the very same opportunity to experience those miracles by yamim maheim uvazman hazeh. Reb Hanani ben Akasha.